Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Chalhas, Judge Jensen, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Please be seated. Welcome this morning to the Court of Appeals. Today is June 12th, 2019. We have six cases on our calendar this morning, three for oral argument. And our first case this morning is A180307, State of Minnesota versus Nathan Janisch. And counsel, you each have 15 minutes for your primary arguments. Counsel for appellant, 5 minutes for rebuttal, if you choose to use it. Go ahead and take the podium. I see it's up very high. It has a toggle switch if you want to bring it down, but make yourself comfortable there, and then whenever you're ready, just state your name and the party you represent.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, court staff, counsel, ladies and gentlemen in the audience. My name is Rory Patrick Durkin, and I represent the petitioner and appellant, Nathan Janisch. I'm a little out of breath and a little sweaty. It was a little touch and go as to whether or not I would be able to argue. So I was in a kind of a panic for the past couple of minutes, and I'm just catching my breath, so I apologize if I seem a little out of breath.
No worries. I appreciate your being attentive to that, but there's no problem whatsoever with your arguing, so thank you.
And thank you, and thank Your Honors. That said, Your Honor, we're here for basically three primary reasons regarding this case. I would say first and foremost, the district court abused its discretion in precluding or denying petitioner's petition for post-conviction relief without an evidentiary hearing on the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel. And what I would posit before Your Honors is pretty egregious ineffective assistance of counsel, and I'll touch on that. The second part is I would say that the district court denied the petitioner's right to have a unanimous verdict, and thirdly, the court abused its discretion in failing to sever some counts with respect to this case. And I think what I'd like to do is I'd like to touch on, first and foremost, the ineffective assistance of counsel and the issues before the court and before the district court with respect to that. Under Minnesota case law, Williams, and the Supreme Court case law, Strickland, I mean, we have to show an order in our petition that counsel's representation fell below an objective standard of reasonableness, and two, that there was a reasonable probability that but for that error or unprofessional errors, the results would have been different. And I think in this particular case, without question, the results would have been different. What's troubling, particularly troubling in this case, is that on the eve of trial, the state added some pretty significant and serious counts. And rather than request a continuance in order to investigate those counts, counsel went forward and despite what his client, Mr. Janisch, wanted, went forward and went to trial. So feeling as if he was ready. Even the district court judge in the transcript asks him, are you sure you don't want a continuance? I mean, this is a criminal sexual conduct case, very serious allegations and very, very serious consequences. And two counts were added that took place in another time in another place, and counsel went forward. And what, despite the judge asking over and over, or at least a couple of times, if he wanted a continuance, and Mr. Janisch wanting a continuance, so, what's troubling?
Counsel, if I may, before you go a little further, I just want to ask you to clear up something for me. Because looking at the motion, the post-conviction motion, and the district court's proceeding, I think had seven grounds, you know, and that you thought deserved at least an evidentiary hearing.
Correct.
Right. But in your brief on appeal, your focus seems to be only on this failure to move to sever, which, one, I don't think was, but correct me if I'm wrong, one of the original seven ones. And also, are you not saying it was error to not give an evidentiary hearing on the original seven?
Yes, absolutely, and I think we touched on that in the brief, and if not...
Maybe you could just point me to that, because I was trying to line those things up.
The first argument is the district court erred by denying appellant a post-conviction evidentiary hearing. That's the first heading on page 3 of our brief. And granted, I think that the petition for post-conviction relief was added in the addendum of our brief, and I think we just focused primarily on the particular severance and a failure to object to allowing the defendant to obtain a unanimous verdict. So I think that by virtue of the appendix being in, the addendum, I think that it's almost incorporated by reference without question. And I think that we do touch on those, some of those issues. We touch on, in our brief, the standard of relief and then ineffective assistance of counsel.
The concern, counsel, is once you get into actual argument, and arguments are forfeited if they're not actually made in the argument, once you get into your argument on the issue on page 6, the analysis, once you get past the standard of review and sort of black-letter law, the analysis seems to be exclusively focused on the failure to file a motion to sever.
Well, in the ineffective assistance of counsel portion, we talk about profit and the prejudice for failing to sever. By mentioning and focusing on the failure to sever, I think swallows many of the other arguments. It swallows the issue or includes the unanimous verdict issue. It includes the lack of a Spriegel analysis. And I think that it does. I don't think by focusing on that particular issue, I don't think that waives any of the other issues that we brought up.
Okay, and then sort of going back like a little bit farther, just in your petition for post-conviction relief, which I think is at addendum, starting at addendum 21. Page 21, did you raise in your petition what you describe in your brief as the problem, which is the failure to file any motion to sever counts? Failure to file any motion to sever. Is that in that petition?
I thought that it was factual basis. I think we have... Well, I think without actually saying and using the actual word sever, I think every issue that is raised stems from or is centered on failing to sever. And basically by trying all 6 of these counts, particularly the Cass County counts and the multiple act counts that were tried, by failing to sever those counts, everything stemmed from that. So maybe if the actual verbiage was not in the brief, clearly all of the issues that stem from that, I would say included and don't necessarily constitute a waiver because the magic word sever wasn't listed in there in that particular section of the post-conviction brief. Every issue in this case, almost every issue, stems from the counts that were added on the eve of trial and defendant's counsel failing to request a continuance, file a motion to sever. Because all of the pitfalls and problems that arose were literally from those particular counts.
So can you address the prejudice argument? The argument, I think, is that even if those had not been included to start with, because they were ultimately dismissed, the middle counts, that they nevertheless are part of the crime that is alleged in the counts 5 and 6, multiple acts.
Well, Your Honors, I mean, once the bell's been rung, it's been rung. I mean,
But in other words, those acts would have come in anyway because they are part of the actual basis for the charges of multiple acts across an extended period of time.
And I respectfully disagree. I don't necessarily agree, and I don't think that we can surmise or guess or speculate as to whether or not that evidence would have come in or not. I don't think they would have or should have. Frankly, under the test for separate acts, course of conduct, et cetera, we have a very distinct time, very distinct place, and I don't know that the evidence, to me, it's Spriegel evidence. You know, any the evidence on counts, the multiple act counts, I don't think should have come in or would have come in, and we don't know. Clearly, we're talking about a different county, Cass County. We're talking about a different act. We don't know what the acts were, and the testimony, I mean, Judge Jasper, stated in his order, look, the evidence would have been the same. But we don't know that. The evidence or testimony would have been the same. But we don't know that because the acts were totally and completely different with respect to time and place and manner. And I think that the state, intentionally or not, was maybe trying to get in some Spriegel evidence without having to go through the proper channels. And I think the district court judge let that in.
Counsel, have you come across any cases involving a district court's decision to vacate guilty verdicts on counts at the end of a trial after deciding that the counts should have been severed, although they were not?
No, and it's, and I know Judge Jasper, I like Judge Jasper, but what happened in that trial, to me, I've never heard of it, and I was as astounded, and anyone that I talk to about it or discuss it looks at me and says, what? And I said, yeah, I know, it's crazy. And that's the first thing I said when Judge Smith, you asked me, I said, yeah, the bell had been rung. You hear all this evidence, and the jury hears all this evidence. Once the bell has been rung and the testimony has been heard, we have all the problems that arise or stem from character evidence and why we don't allow it, a whole propensity, or if where there's smoke, there's fire. If he did it in Anoka, he must have done it in Cass County, or vice versa, I think, in this case.
Well, with respect to the multiple counts that weren't severed ever, the guilty verdicts weren't vacated,
right?
And the court decided that those counts were properly litigated. If they involved multiple counts in two different counties, why would evidence with respect to counts, acts that occurred in another county, have been excluded at the trial?
Because we don't know that, because I don't know, and I don't think any of us know that the testimony or the evidence would have necessarily been the same with respect to those particular counts. We don't know that, and if they would have been excluded prior to trial or severed prior to trial, I think in order to even get the testimony in, there would have been a fight or an argument about whether or not the particular facts related to the Cass County allegations could have been introduced at trial in the first place. So, and I think that's what that touches on. In addition to what I would say denying Mr. Janisch's right to a unanimous verdict, I think that...
If we may spend a moment on a unanimous verdict, why isn't the fact that the jury, in fact, rendered 6 unanimous verdicts, including on the two that were then ultimately dismissed. Does that not tell us that, in fact, there was unanimity, even if required, as to all of the acts that were charged?
I don't know. Does it?
Well,
and that's a good question. And, okay. and I say that because we don't know. And that's why...
What don't we know?
We don't know if juror number one felt that Mr. Janish was guilty on counts three and four, but not the five and six. But,
and why don't we know that if there were specific verdicts on each of counts one through six?
Because
the fact that those are dismissed, even though they were unanimously found, does that sort of change the calculus? Or why can't we just look at those jury findings on each of those counts where they said we have unanimously found on count one, on count two, on count three, on count four, on count five, and count six?
Because I think that I don't know where my brain just went. I think because... Well, that's a good question, because we don't know, and because the jurors weren't polled. I think maybe had they been polled and had they been talked to and asked whether or not each juror was unanimous on each particular count, we don't know. And we don't know if that's a good question, and that's part of the problem with this case as well. Mr. Janish was entitled to a unanimous verdict, and we don't know. Just because there was a slip of paper signed, I think that the counsel should have polled the jurors and asked them. And we don't know what influenced that decision or verdict at all. Your Honors, my time is running short. First off, I would like to thank you for allowing me to argue this case this morning. And we would respectfully request that either Mr. Janice's conviction be reversed, or in the alternative, his conviction be reversed and he be granted a new trial. And at the very least, he should have been granted an evidentiary hearing on the question of ineffective assistance of counsel, because, Your Honors, the reality is a golf trip with your Notre Dame buddies and a boating trip, a kayaking trip with your college buddies up in upstate New York or whatever the case might be simply isn't enough to justify counsel's actions in this case, at least with respect to preparation for trial and maybe granting a continuance on the when those four counts were added. Thank you so much, Your Honor.
Counsel, there's just one question here.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Well, in that letter in which counsel outlined his various personal and professional conflicts, didn't he end the letter by saying, but most importantly, the defendant does not want a continuance because this has been affecting his life for the last several months, And didn't counsel emphasize? And so, are you telling us that was not true?
No, Your Honor, I am not. And if you look at the date, and if my memory is correct, I think that the continuance request was June 26th. The letter was June 29th, and the basis for the continuance was with one of the state's witness problems. And then a couple of week and a half later, the state added those counts the eve of trial.
I'm sorry. So what you're saying then is that it was the attorney's personal and professional conflicts that drove his decision not to request a continuance at the date of trial?
I think it's very, very clear,
right.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Kelsey Kelly, and I represent the state of Minnesota in this case. I'd like to start off by clarifying the procedural record in this matter. It is true that in the defendant's post-conviction petition, he did not raise the issue of failure to sever. And then on appeal, he only raised the issue with regard to failure to sever when arguing the fact that he did not get his evidentiary hearing was improper by the district court. So procedurally, I think he is barred from arguing other issues outside of that with regard to the evidentiary hearing. Also, I'd like to clarify that although the complaint was amended close to trial, it was not the eve of trial. There were 5 days between when the amendment happened and when the trial started. And in appellant's brief with regard to Spriegel, they only argue Spriegel with regard to what they call the third act within Anoka County. They don't argue that with regard to Cass County. So I just want to clarify that. I want to get to the heart of some of the issues in this case with regard to counts 5 and 6. As the court knows, Mr. Janisch was only convicted on count 5 and not count 6 because count 6 was a lesser included offense. However, count 5 is multiple acts. So the offense itself includes multiple incidents, even though it is one crime. So that allows the incidents between Anoka County and Cass County to come into one criminal offense within Anoka County.
And what case best supports the proposition that you can prosecute a defendant in one county for acts that occur in another county simply because you've charged the defendant with multiple acts? Because we have a district court here who decided that the defendant should not have been prosecuted for the acts in Cass County. But you're saying simply by charging out multiple acts, he could be prosecuted for apparently a variety of counties in one county.
That's exactly what I'm
saying.
And
what case do you have to support that proposition?
Well, I'd first like to cite to the statute, because that's what I have in front of me. Minnesota statute section 609.353 states that multiple acts charges of criminal sexual conduct, quote, may be prosecuted in any jurisdiction in which the violation originates or terminates. And I believe in my brief, I did cite cases that cite to that statute.
I think that is the statute the judge was applying when it decided that the Cass County acts could not be prosecuted in Anoka.
Yes, and the reason why the
so
judge...
So can I just ask you, is there a case that you have in support of your argument? You can move on if you don't have a case.
So State v. Larson, which is 620 Northwest 2nd, 456... this court in 1994 is what I have cited in my brief, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I'd also like to clarify what the district court did here. The reason why the district court vacated counts 3 and 4 was because those were charged just as a single act in Cass County, which is different than the multiple acts statute. Those are totally different statutes that have different jurisdictional hooks. So counts 3 and 4 were vacated later because the judge decided that the victim was not found in Anoka County.
And what do you mean when you say jurisdictional? Do you mean venue? Or
venue. I think venue. Thank you. Thank you for clarifying that. Yes, I do mean venue. So the reason why the district court vacated those convictions is because it didn't have the hook between the two counties like counts 5 and 6 did. Counts 3 and 4 had to stand on their own for venue in Cass County, which... that doesn't change the fact that the evidence still would have come in with regard to Cass County on counts 5 and 6 because the offense itself can span between two different counties. It also takes care of the issue that's in appellant's brief that was not argued today with regard to the third act that happened in Anoka County. That is also included in counts 5 and 6. So I think that was properly brought into court. Also, the defense attorney did not object to that coming into court, and it only took up approximately 4 pages of that transcript. And with regard to the unanimous verdict, I think the fact that they found him guilty on all 6 counts does show us that it was a unanimous verdict. But even
more... It's so quirky what's happened here. I mean, is it okay to rely on guilty verdicts when the convictions are ultimately vacated because they should not have been there in the first place?
I think it is, Your Honor, but there's more than that in this case. Here we also have proper jury instructions. We presume that the jury follows its instructions, and the district court judge instructed the jury with regard to one act in Anoka County and with regard to one act in Cass County, and the jury still convicted him on counts 5 and 6. So if you look at the jigs,
could the jury have not convicted on 5 and 6 based on there were ultimately two acts, right, in Anoka County? The one act and then the so-called third act.
Yes, Your Honor.
What tells us that did the instructions preclude the jury from deciding that there were two acts in Anoka County and no act in Cass County?
No, Your Honor, I don't think it precludes that.
Okay.
And actually, there's case law saying that where there are alternate means of committing an offense, the jury does not all have to agree on the exact way in which the offense was committed, just that they all have to agree that the elements of the offense were met. So a verdict
So there were three possible acts that the jury could consider for counts 5 and 6, and they could, and they did not have to unanimously agree, you're arguing, as to which of those three acts constituted the multiple acts.
Right. They could have, the jury, in theory, could have chosen from any three of those acts based on the evidence that was presented at trial. However, based on the jigs and based on the prosecutor's closing argument, she also argued one act in Anoka County, one act in Cass County. And part of that is because the victim in this case, while they were doing trial prep, remembered the second act at the Andover home, and it was disclosed to defense. And I think that's part of why he did not object at trial, because the disclosure was made and the defense attorney was expecting it. Also, factually, the two incidents in Andover were very similar in how they occurred and the way the victim describes them.
And what's the best case that you have for the argument that the jury doesn't have to unanimously agree as to the underlying, each individual underlying act?
So, Your Honor, it's State v. Hayes. It's 831 Northwest 2nd, 546. And in my brief, I think I actually cited about four or five other cases that go for that proposition. But, Your Honor, I do think if we look at the fact that the jury convicted him on every single count, I do think that that helps the state's case. I don't think that there was confusion here, especially based on the way that each of these incidents happened were so similar. They were all similar. They all involved oral sex, and they all happened in the same manner where the victim was going to bed and the appellant was supposed to be helping put her to bed. I don't think that the jury was impacted by possibly hearing something. I'm referring to the third act in Anoka County. I don't think that that impacted the jury because it was so similar.
Ms. Kelly, can I take you back?
Yes.
To the issue about an evidentiary hearing on the petition for post-conviction relief. So if we decide that the seven grounds for post-conviction relief dealing with ineffective counsel that were in the original petitioner before us, and as you probably gathered from my question, I have real questions about that, but let's assume that.
Okay.
So let me ask you about the ground that, I'm reading it, trial counsel guaranteed petitioner that he would not be convicted of these charges. If we found that that was properly before, shouldn't we be remanding for an evidentiary hearing? Wouldn't that require an evidentiary hearing, just looking at our standard, that unless these facts and records conclusively show the petitioner is entitled to no relief, you get a hearing? And that's the one that stood out to me. I thought, why wasn't there a hearing?
So, Your Honor, first I want to preserve the issue that I don't think that you should rule on that. But
and I tried to be really clear with my caveat here.
I think that it completely defies common sense based on if you read everything that happened pre-trial. The defendant knew he was looking at going to prison for up to 144 months. That was said over and over and over again. I think the judge even warned him that this was a prison case. It's not reasonable for an appellant to believe that when he is facing a criminal sexual conduct trial against a child. I think it's just common sense. We know as a community that that would send you to prison if you were convicted. In the post-conviction petition, he didn't actually give anything to say that. So he wrote that in the petition, but there wasn't an affidavit to support it. There wasn't anything else to actually support that. The defense attorney, of course, did not write that. I have a hard time believing any defense attorney would really say that out loud, and perhaps if he did, that's an ethics issue, because we all know that that's horrible, unethical advice. But I think that we need a little bit more in the record to grant an evidentiary hearing on that, especially when the judge warned him pretrial multiple times. So it's not as if he had no clue of what was happening.
Well, what about the paragraph in the affidavit in which the appellant states that he begged his attorney to request a continuance after the new charges were added to the complaint?
Well, I think that contradicts part of what's in the record as well, Your Honor, because the defendant also wanted to get the trial over with. We also, if you look at the Strickland standard, how would we say that the result would have been different? I guess, so the issue is, even though the counts were added by the state 5 days before trial, the evidence in the case did not change. The evidence was the same. It's just that the state decided to add more counts using that same evidence. So we would have to find a way that the defense was prejudiced, even though they did not receive more evidence. Also, I think he was looking at the same presumptive prison commit, even with the added offenses. So it's not as though he was looking at such a significant period more of prison time. And actually, Mr. Janisch did not go to prison in this case. There was a dispositional departure. But I don't see how we could meet the prejudice, the second prong of Strickland, even if we were to concede that it fell below an objective standard of reasonableness. If there are no further questions of me, I ask the court to affirm Mr. Janisch's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, any rebuttal?
Just very briefly, if I may have just a second, Your
Honor. Sure.
Once again, good morning, Your Honors. Rory Durkin representing Mr. Janisch. Just briefly, I just wanted to touch, and I know you, there's a busy calendar, and we've hashed a couple of these issues out, but one thing I wanted to touch on, with respect to, it's a very different for a defendant to wish to go forward with trial when there's a critical witness that is unable to be available on the day of trial. So it's not inconceivable for Mr. Janisch to want to not grant the state a continuance for that reason at that time, versus requesting a continuance when on the eve of trial, and yes, maybe it was 5 days, but a couple of those days were a weekend. So when those accounts were added on the eve of trial, and they were of such a seriousness and a magnitude that would require a probable cause challenge, perhaps hire an investigator, a continuance would absolutely have been requested, and it was, and Mr. Janisch even stated so in his affidavit. So that's not inconsistent, I guess I wanted to say. And as far as whether or not the issues in the post-conviction brief are properly before Your Honors, by virtue of their referring to the post-conviction petition throughout the brief, as well as a separate heading discussing ineffective assistance of counsel, I think that the brief does incorporate that petition. It incorporates it by reference without question, and I think that those issues are properly before the court. And if you look through the brief, in other sections of the brief, the words ineffective assistance of counsel are mentioned in other places as well. So that said, once again, I would respectfully request that you at the either reverse Mr. Janice's conviction and grant him a new trial, or at the very least grant him an evidentiary hearing on the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel. Thank you, Your Honors. Have a nice day.
Great. Thank you both. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time frame. Thank you.